salzigen Jam von den menschlichen Träumen. Gehefind sich ein schrecklicher Tom. Gehefind sich ein schrecklicher Tom. Erkennst du nicht tiefe, nicht finstere Wärme. In Zeiten der blutiger Strom. Im Toben tausender Jahren gegraben. Emune und Sinne und Pein. Und tausender Jahren als Tropfen nach Tropfen. Es kissen sich Tränen herein. Beneath the salt sea of humanity's weeping, a terrible chasm abides. It couldn't be darker, it couldn't be deeper. It is stained with a bloody red tide. So much of the sea has been filled with the sorrows endured by the suffering Jews. But only the tears of the poor ones are bloody. The rich cry as clear as the dew.
Welcome to New Yiddish Rep Radio Hour. I know that song said suffering Jews, but I played it because I want to send it out to the people of Egypt. And with the fervent hope and prayer that what is happening there results in a better life for them and their children and their children's children. So having said that, I want to welcome our guest today, Rachel Kafrisen. Hi, Rachel. How you doing?
I'm good. A little tired.
A little tired. Well, you know, that's the lament of the attorney, of the eternal counselor.
Right? Well, yeah. We'll talk about that.
But that is not that is only a sideshow for you. You are a journalist and observer of the Yiddish scene, not only here but all over the world. And there are a lot of questions I'd like to ask you about your thoughts about Yiddish, the future of Yiddish, your experience of the whole movement. So. The first thing I want to ask you is, at this point in time, I know you've been observing and writing for quite a long time and participating. What are your hopes for the future of Yiddish and Yiddish culture?
What are my hopes? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I think it's sort of small-scale goals, but maybe I'm asking even too much. I would like to see the conversation, the way that we discuss Yiddish in the Jewish community, I would like to see that discussion change a little bit, and the terms of that discussion change. And then I think that if we can start to have a new kind of discussion about Yiddish, I think that we can have some changes happen, and we can see some exciting new things develop.
Okay, could you elaborate on that, and how would you, what change would you, how should this new approach be? What should it be? How should we be talking about?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that when we talk about Yiddish, our potential is limited by the framework of our language. So that in the media, for example, like, you, David, and our friends, when we receive media attention from mainstream media, whether it's the New York Times or the Jewish Week, our projects are discussed in terms of revival, in terms of renaissance, in terms of bringing Yiddish back from the dead. Yiddish is dying. No, it's being revived. No, it's dead again. Oops. So we're endlessly put into this box of death and revival, to the point where we can't talk about continuity. And each project is seen as being anomalous, right? Each project, rather than being linked to something that happened right before it or linked to something right next to it, everything is seen atomized and decontextualized, because otherwise there's no story, because we don't know how to talk about Yiddish as something that's normal, as something that should be part of our lives. It's a rather dysfunctional way of seeing our culture.
So how much of this is the short-sightedness of the media, and how much of it is actually the fault of we ourselves, the Yiddishisten and the Yiddish organizations?
Well, you know, I should say I'm not here to place blame. I mean, you know, honestly, I think we all have some responsibility in it. Certainly in the media, I mean, you can't expect a New York Times journalist to really have a grasp of the intricacies of Yiddish and, you know, really care about seeing the big picture. But I do think it is the responsibility of the subjects, if a New York Times reporter comes or any kind of reporter comes, that we should really be very clear about the terms on which we're doing our projects. And we should make sure we do as much as possible to steer it so that we do, I believe that we ourselves have a responsibility. We also use these terms ourselves. We're not always as careful, or we're not always as thoughtful about how we discuss our projects and what we do.
It's interesting you mentioned the New York Times a couple of times. At the recent reading of Merchant Shylock, the Yiddish Merchant of Venice, there was a journalist from the Times, and I fear that he will not print anything.
Anything at all?
I haven't seen anything yet, and, you know, it was a couple of weeks ago. So unless he's waiting for a special occasion, I fear that nothing will appear in print about it. Although it was interesting that the Times did find it interesting enough to come down and cover it, whether they print something about it or not.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could tell the audience, you know, just so everything's out on the table, I worked on that production.
Of course.
The subtitles. Yeah. I was up in the booth. And, you know, I would be surprised that there wasn't more media there, because it was, you know, it was kind of a newsworthy thing. It was not only sold out, it was oversold. You know, people were banging on the door to get in.
That's true. But so far our coverage has been limited. I have to tell you that the English Forward is the only media that I've seen any coverage in. And, you know, I don't want to second guess them, or, you know, I'm not beating my breast about it. But I certainly thought it was newsworthy. And an interesting development that you might find interesting in is that the Globe Theatre Company in London is planning a 2012 festival in which they are going to produce all the works of Shakespeare in 38 different languages. So I sent them off an email suggesting that they do Merchant of Venice in Yiddish and assuring them that we are prepared to present it. Let's see if there's any interest there. I cannot think of a more appropriate foreign language language other than Shakespeare's English for that play to be presented in. So we'll see if they respond. But getting back to what you were saying, it is a fact, though, that I understand what you're saying about there not being a continuity, but how do we create a framework in which continuity is possible? It often seems that the various organizations that are trying to deal with this have either lost their way or are scratching their heads as though to say, well, we really don't have a mission anymore. We really don't have a demographic anymore. And there seems to be a lot of mevet fablonjit abyssal here. We're wandering around scratching our heads. How do we create a context for ourselves that will work?
Okay, well, you know, I would say step zero for all these organizations, if you want to build an audience, right, you have to educate not only the audience you have already, but the audience that you want. So if organizations are scratching their head and don't even know why they exist, well, you know, as you know, that's a crisis. That's a real problem. These organizations have to have a very clear understanding of what they're doing and why, and be able to communicate that to themselves and to the people that they want to attract. Otherwise, you know, that's it. You're done. You're toast.
Well, how do they do that? How do you? Because it is a problem. It's not that they're. It's not like I'm saying that there's no reason for them to feel this way. It's really a daunting problem. It's. You ask yourself, how do you get a new audience? How do you get a younger audience? How do you get people interested? And you see things like summer program in Vilnius and the Weinreich Center summer program. It seems that the net effect of all these programs is that instead of increasing the number of people, it's splitting up. You know, it's all of them are getting less people.
Well, I
know you've been to Vilnius and you've participated in that program. How did you feel about it? What was your sense of that experience?
Well, okay, so there's a couple different questions here. I mean, first I want to say that I think that a lot of these organizations and people who do Yiddish do suffer from a crisis of confidence, that people who do Yiddish themselves are not quite 100% confident in its value and its usefulness and the fact that they're doing something legitimate. And because there's so much negative rhetoric about Yiddish within Jewish culture and the culture at large, that people are a little bit abashed about it. They're not quite sure how to talk about it. They might make apologies. They're not sure how to present it in a way that's really strong and self-confident. So first of all, I think that we need to have more confidence in ourselves and our projects. I mean, maybe you might not think it's so, or you might think that's a little bit elementary, but from my point of view, it's not. Because I often see people will say, I have arguments with people, for example, when there's an article in the Times that once again indulges in this kind of talk, look at this, we're going to take a very narrow look, and we're going to look at some Yiddish organization and say, oh, it's horrible, Yiddish is dead, but this one organization is making it live again, and they make it seem like it's this very decontextualized, anomalous thing. And then I say, well, that's, you know what, an article like that doesn't help us at all, because what funder is going to look at this article and say, oh, it's a bunch of losers who are not connected to anything and have no future, so... why would I give them money? That's a fucking waste of money. Excuse my Yiddish, but it is. Right?
There is no censorship on this program. You can say whatever you like.
Okay, so but the problem is that I get into arguments with people in the community, and this happens all the time. Who will say to me, "Any publicity is good publicity." That you have to understand that a reporter from the Times can't be expected to have more of a larger grasp than, just the easy kind of cliche of Yiddish dying. Oh, but look at this person doing something. Isn't that great? And I think that's a problem, because I think, no, not just any publicity is good publicity, because if it only furthers this marginalization of Yiddish, no one is going to give you money. If you don't have any money, you can't do anything.
Well, isn't it a fact, though, Rachel, that there is a great deal of money available to a lot of these organizations? And, I have no, let's not mince words. The Forward is sitting on an awful lot of money, despite the fact that they plead poverty. The Workman's Circle, now they sold that building, they're sitting on some money, despite the fact that they plead poverty. YIVO they're not exactly suffering from, National Yiddish Book Center. These are organizations with a considerable amount of money at their disposal. However, their attitude seems to be, we need to conserve this money so that we can survive, get to our retirement age, and collect our pensions.
Well,
and maybe have our children, some of our children, take over our jobs. Now, I might be opening myself up for a lot of criticism saying this, but that's how it seems to me. If you have the money and your attitude is, I'm not going to spend it because I want to squeeze it and preserve my particular bureaucracy for as long as I can, then what are we going to accomplish? So to me, the issue is not so much money as what you said at the beginning. And that is, you need the balls and the imagination to use the money properly and effectively.
Well, David, look, I mean, I don't want to get into questions about what, you know, those three organizations have or don't have and what their vision is. I mean, they all have their own particular missions. I mean, the Book Center has a mission of saving books, and they do it, and they've raised a tremendous amount of money. I mean, I have my own critique of the center in the sense that, you know, I think it's, I wish their mission were more expansive.
The same be said of many of these, of many of the Yiddishist organizations.
But what I'm talking about is more, for example, the recent coverage of the crisis at Zico.
Okay. At the Times, our friend Joe Berger at the Times.
Right.
Part of the problem, I think you hit the nail on the head at the beginning in terms of saying that we are facing a crisis of confidence. People don't honestly believe, the people that are involved or should be involved in pursuing this, giving us a context for going forward, really don't believe that there's any hope at all in succeeding. And this is a huge problem. I'll give you an example. There's a thing called the Yiddish National Theater, as opposed to the Volksbühne, which is the National Yiddish Theater. This reading of The Merchant of Venice of Shylock was the first time in 30 years that they have put their name on a production, and it is a theater company.
Okay.
You know, it's a theater company that was associated with the Hebrew Actors Union. Many of the people involved, or a portion of the people involved, are the same people involved in SECO. You know, a great deal of this can be traced to a lack of confidence and infighting, constant and continuous infighting of people just not being able to get along for a few minutes to accomplish anything. This is a Jewish thing, as we know.
Yeah.
But how do we get past that? How do we get past that and move forward? It's that is why it is very often daunting. I have to go back to The Merchant of Venice. One of the things I am proudest of about that was that the people assembled for that reading managed to get through the whole thing, not only present of what I thought was a very nice presentation, but they managed to get through it without bloodshed. So, unfortunately, at one point I turned to the people backstage before the show. I was sitting there and I was listening, and the actors were back there, and there were, you know, maybe a dozen people back there. And all of a sudden I realized that the entire conversation in that room was being conducted in Yiddish. Uh-huh. And I stopped everyone and I said, now I know what it feels like to be part of a Yiddish theater company. I never knew that before. I never had that feeling before. Despite all the years that I worked for the folks with the Volksbühne and for the Volksbühne, despite all the years that I've been trying to do something with New Yiddish Rep, that was the first time I ever personally got the feeling, gee, this is what it must be like to actually be part of a Yiddish theater company. And, I thought that in itself was an achievement. The problem is I don't know how to take it any further. So I'm looking for advice. Right.
Well, you know, David, I think that you yourself are having a crisis of confidence in the sense that, like, you know what you need to do because clearly you're doing it. And you have a vision. There's something that, like, when things are going the way they should be going and when you hit this critical mass of getting together people who can actually execute that vision, like, it clicks, right? Mm-hmm. You're mm-hmm. saying you recognize that. So as hard as it is, like, that's it. You need to just keep doing what you're doing as best as you can and, you know, not, you know, letting it make you totally insane or bankrupt you. But, like, you know, I think that's it. Like, it's, you know, sometimes, like, have you ever gone to a psychic?
No.
Okay, well.
Yes, I did. I did when I was a kid in the hills of Scotland, in the Highlands. I went to some, a tinker woman read my tea leaves.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, my experience with seeking the advice of a psychic or an astrologer or something like that in general is that the questions that you bring to them, you know the answer you want to hear.
Yeah.
And, you know, you pretty much know these things. What you're looking for is someone to tell you that you're right or tell you that, you know, you've made the right decisions, things are going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing magic. I mean, it's really, really, really hard. If you look at the history of, you know, just if you look at the history of Yiddish theater in New York, you see, you know, theater companies were always forming and splitting up and all these personalities were conflicting and just, you know, certainly artistic endeavors in general. Or literary endeavors, like the history of Yiddish publications. You know, publications would, you know, in excitement, they'd come together, they'd issue six issues of a journal, and then fold. I mean, it was a miracle when a newspaper lasted a year.
That's correct.
So
that's always the case.
Right? Seriously, like, it's not a joke. Like, it's not about, this is what I mean about confidence. It's not about what you should be doing better. It's about you saying, like, what you've managed to accomplish, you pretty much alone, it's pretty fucking miraculous, and if it feels right to you, it's right, you know? Like,
this is absolutely true. I don't mean to in any way put myself down or diminish what we have accomplished. You know, the frustrating thing, Rachel, is that the well is so deep and so full of treasure that when you go to it and realize how little of it is being mined,
yeah,
it becomes frustrating.
I agree.
I have to tell you a little story. I sent out an appeal for donations to the people who came to see Merchant. And I'll tell you this, and I'm at the point where I don't feel like keeping any secrets in the bag, you know. We wanted to make an appeal. We did it for free. Yeah. So we wanted to make an appeal to the audience, as you know that all our shows are free.
Mm-hmm.
And we tell people you're going to get an envelope in your program. And if you want to give us a donation, do it on the way out. So we were told we couldn't do that. YIVO wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow a public solicitation of funds for another organization. This is something that we run into constantly. You know, I remember going to the JCC on 76th Street and asking them to display our flyers for our productions. They refused to do it because they will only display things that are generated within the JCC framework. Then we decided we were going to do it. We were just going to put an envelope in the program and write a little something in the program notes. Then we were told we couldn't do that. And I had printed up 300 of these envelopes and cards. And I said to a gentleman over there, I said, what do you want me to do? Throw these away. So finally we did the Jewish thing. We did it anyway. and we didn't say anything to anybody. We just did it. I sent out an email reminding people to send us something. And I said, if you want to support cutting edge Yiddish theater, send us some money. So I got an email from a woman who was indignant. She said, if this is cutting edge Yiddish, how come I could only understand 10% of it? And I kind of scratched my head. And we had a discussion just yesterday with Mel Cederbaum from Toronto about a show that Shane Baker, you know, Shane Baker does Wortkunst.
Mm-hmm. I know very well, yes.
And one of the things Mel said was that people, when he had done it last year in Toronto, people said that they couldn't understand. It was hard for them to follow the Yiddish.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Which, you know, Shane's response was, that's why from now on I'm going to take super titles. But this gives you an idea of what we've come to. Now, the Yiddish...